Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night yet again. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody and Silas. And Brody is already at Emporia. The World Championship starts a week from today. Is that right?
Tuesday?
Yeah, Tuesday. Yeah, it's Tuesday through Saturday?
Yeah, we go Jones Supreme. Well, it's depending on if you're Pool A or Pool B. Pool A will have all the high-rated players. It'll be Jones Supreme, Country Club, Jones Supreme, Country Club, Country Club. They'll make a cut after four rounds and then Country Club.
And then the finals at Country Club.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's – we'll talk about Worlds here in a second, but remind me when we get there that I think to bring up – I don't understand why it's going Tuesday through Saturday instead of Wednesday through Sunday. But we'll talk about that later, because first we got to talk through Des Moines, which happened this past weekend. And the first storyline of it that I think is pretty obvious that I want to get your experience as a player was the weather situation that came in. And then obviously you had to play two rounds on Saturday morning. There's several cards that had to do that. How did that change the dynamic of the tournament, do you think?
So I think the first thing with the weather is obviously the Disc Golf Pro Tour is very, very cautious. They have, I believe it's a 10-mile radius that they do. So any lightning strikes within 10 miles, they'll pull everyone off. The thing that I think, which is fine, and like you're not gonna see any valid arguments from any players saying like, no, we should be playing right now.
Yeah,
because the way it turned out, where the storm cells ended up kind of missing just north or just south, and we're just kind of moving to the
So it didn't even hit the course really.
No, but there was a really, really bad cell, and I don't know if you saw Gannon's Instagram post, but that was sitting right on top of us in Des Moines, and we were just south of there, about 15 miles or so south. But lightning strikes from that cell were getting within 10 miles from us. So I think that all makes sense. I would say the only thing that was slightly frustrating was it seemed like we could have gone back out and played, but more storms were supposed to come in. And so that's where it was kind of weird, because it wasn't like one of those of like, all right, guys, well, we're just canceling today. No way we can do it. The weather's just trash. It was one of those of like, well, we could send you back out there, but it would probably all be only for 30 minutes. And then we'd have to pull you right back off because these storms are coming. Well, I don't think the storms ended up ever actually coming. So... It was one of those of where obviously they were being, you know, cautious with everything. And I can see their side of things of like, yeah, do we want to start up the live stream just to have to stop it 30 minutes? You know, there's a lot of logistical stuff, I'm sure, that made sense to, you know, not just to suspend the round for the day.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things of where, you know, me, Ezra, and Calvin were all practice putting outside of our hotel at, you know, 7:30 all the way through to like 8:30. And we were kind of like, man, like at the end of the day, we probably could have gotten 9, 10, 11, 12 holes in. So I understand both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's one of those where I think if the Pro Tour probably had more resources, that for sure they would have sent people out. And it's also a rule too of like, there's not really anything in the PDGA, or I guess there's stuff in the PDGA rules that you can basically interpret both ways. You can interpret to where it's like, all right, well, round one never happened. We're going to play a two-round tournament. And then you can interpret of, we can just finish the rounds the next day and it's fine. I did hear something about like 13 holes. I don't think that's actually...
That's 13 holes is what it requires to be like an official rated round is what that rule is.
Okay, so that doesn't have any impact then on actually playing, like having it be part.
I don't know what. Yeah, I don't know how much that like affects. Like, is the PDGA like, since it's not a rated round, it doesn't count towards the tournament? I just know 13 is the minimum to get a rating.
That's,
I know
I,
that's
think,
true.
There's a lot of interpretation.
Yeah,
I think how they ended up doing it was the best way they could have done it. You know,
yeah.
I don't think having, if you can have a 3-round tournament, I don't think having 2 rounds is the way to go. Like,
yeah,
just to have 2 rounds. And the way I view it is like, at the end of the day, everything is going to probably even itself out throughout the season. You're going to have some times where you're going to have good draws where, you know, you're going to tee off in the afternoon and the weather was terrible in the morning and you got good weather in the afternoon. And mm-hmm. I think that stuff kind of all evens itself out. So, you know, I'm sure there are some people complaining about, I had to play 2 rounds in one day, or the weather was actually a lot better on Friday than Saturday. So
yeah.
Hence why you saw like people shoot 11, 10, 9 under on Friday. And then I think the only Bradley Williams and Emerson Keith out of the cards that played in the morning, those were the two hot rounds in the morning, and they were both 8 under. So
yeah.
The scoring was definitely different. I think you also saw it from the FPO side too, of where the FPO had a lot of people play really, really well on Friday. Saturday, the scores got kind of brought back. So scoring was a lot harder on Saturday, but again, it's one of those things where I think all that does even out. It definitely sucks when you are in a tournament where you're on the bad side of the draw. But it's just kind of how it works. The one thing I would say that is, I would say if we were trying to pinpoint something that was maybe unfair and something that maybe needs to get looked at a certain point in time, is the handful of people that are like consistently on feature cards. I have no problem with them being on feature cards. They need to be on feature cards because that's what pays the bills. And that's ultimately
yeah.
what's going to drive viewership up, which is ultimately going to hopefully bring in sponsors. And then that trickles all the way down to all the other players. So I'm definitely not one of those people that thinks feature cards should be something where everyone should get on and it should be sprinkled
yeah.
around. But I will say there is definitely a super advantage to being on a feature card consistently and always playing in the afternoon and never having a random 10 o'clock tee time, 10:30 tee time. There's nothing we can do about it right now just because of how the Pro Tour is set up with the Disc Golf Network. But that
yeah.
is something that probably does need to look, be addressed and looked into at some point, of where if they aren't super time constrained of like, no, we're only filming at this time, so we need to have the feature cards this time always. That would be something that probably needs to be looked at, because I do think maybe those tee times need to be a little, on the first day at least, need to be a little bit more random as far as when they go off.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, you looking at the tournament, it's pretty obvious that there was a distinct disadvantage to the players that went off Saturday morning. Like you said, there was nothing to be done about it, and it's not really like a knock against the tournament or anything.
Was
but
Emerson,
I mean,
the highest finisher for the people that had to go off 2 rounds?
I think so. Yeah, but I mean, you had 4 of the best players in the world. Which you have 5, 4. You had Chris, Calvin, Paul, Ricky, all going off Saturday morning, and the best one of them finished 16th. And then you had like 35th, 57th, which for the 4 of them, you know, typically at least one's going to be in the top. Actually, pretty much, I'd be curious if the stats true, but I would imagine every tournament they start, one of them's in the top 10, surely. Because like the 4 of them, someone's going to play good.
Mm-hmm.
So to see all 4 of them farther down the leaderboard, I think is, you know, proof enough that there's a slight disadvantage that Saturday morning. But like you said, they could have been less cautious, but I don't think you ever want the Pro Tour to be less cautious about weather, because
correct.
all it takes is one time, one instance with a spectator or a player, and then, you know, you have a whole different set of issues versus the issue we're dealing with now is like maybe someone else would have won the tournament, or maybe someone else would have finished in the top 10 is basically what it boils down to. So, but in that morning group, you were able to put together a pretty solid round. I believe you shot 6 under that morning.
Mm-hmm.
But then the afternoon round, you kind of struggled through, and it looked like you were getting affected by your knee is what it seemed like on coverage. Was that mainly just from playing 2 rounds in one day under tournament pressure, or like what exactly was going on?
Yeah, so I twisted my ankle pretty bad at letdown. And I think that kind of, you know, sometimes when you jack something else in your body, it ends up putting a lot more pressure on another joint kind of in your body.
You, like, change how you walk and stuff like that.
And so I think that ended up kind of tweaking my knee a little bit. And I've been able to manage it pretty well just simply by, you know, reducing the amount of throwing I've been doing and increasing recovery as far as doing the Normatec stretching, foam rolling, icing, elevating, all those type of things to kind of keep the swelling in check. That day was just, it was just a tough one to do where, you know, you start at 7 a.m, you end up finishing around 12 or so, then you have like a 4-hour break. And then you get back to warming up and then going back out there. It was definitely frustrating because this is a course, one of my favorite tournaments to play. It's also a very fun course to play. And it's one that I think I can be very competitive at.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I ended up starting fine and picked up a couple bogeys on, 3, 4, 5, and 6, I think, something like that, just by throwing OB shots. Five was causing me problems all week until I finally went forehand the final round.
Yeah, I was surprised you weren't going forehand.
Yeah, the wind.
Was it wind?
Yeah, it was just the headwind was really bad on Saturday on that hole, and I told myself pre-tournament, like, it was a headwind, I'm going backhand. And I think I should just – I need to trust my forehand into a headwind. And yeah. I wasn't doing that on Saturday. But, yeah, those first couple bogeys, those were all just bad shots that all ended up going OB. But my knee was still feeling fine. So I'm not making excuses and saying my knee caused me to throw those OB shots. It wasn't probably until, like, maybe hole 10 that I started kind of – feeling it a little bit, I would say, to the point of where it was starting to maybe affect my timing. And then it took me a couple holes, but then I just started, like, figuring out how to throw without really using my lower body, if that makes sense. So I was definitely throwing a lot more upper body stuff. And I was still able to I think I ended up shooting like a couple under par on the back nine. So I was managed to kind of salvage something, but yeah, that round was very, very tough for me, and I just didn't play well, which was really unfortunate because I was still kind of in the mix at 6 under.
Yeah.
And I knew obviously that Saturday was going to play pretty tough in the afternoon. It wasn't as windy in the morning, but it was still windier than it was on Friday, so I knew scores weren't gonna be as good as Friday. And yeah, I think kind of looking at my tournament and like the overhaul of my tournament, I think one thing, especially going into Worlds, that I really need to work on is just picking my shots. I've kind of gone too much on the extreme of, like, trying to birdie everything, and when I don't throw a good shot, trying to throw an incredible shot to still get the birdie, because I know that, you know, you have to get birdies to win tournaments out here. But I think I've gone a little bit too extreme on that. And looking at my final round is kind of a perfect example of that. I can just go through my final round right now just to kind of, because I'm throwing the disc really, really well. And I need to work on my putting still. Like, last night I spent about 2 hours or so putting, and I'm going to probably do that consistently throughout this week to try to get back to, because I know my circle one putting has been killing me in this tournament as well. I think I was like 70%, like hole 10, which is that easy par five. It's like, you got to birdie that hole. I missed a circle one putt, made par. And then the final day, I missed the circle one putt, airballed it to where it rolled OB. and then made the comeback for bogey. So it's like that's three shots right there on that hole that you just can't afford. So I know my simple one putting is killing me right now. But as far as throwing goes, just to give an idea of how well I was throwing the disc the final day, hole one, I was circle one, missed the birdie putt. Hole two, circle one, made it. Hole three, circle one, made it. Hole four, circle one, made it. Hole five, circle one, missed it. Hole six, parked. Hole seven, just outside circle one, missed it. Hole eight was off the fairway, so I didn't have a birdie putt. Hole nine, parked. Hole 10, circle one, missed for birdie. Hole 11, circle one, parked. Hole 12, circle one, make. Hole 13, parked. Hole 14, circle one, make. Hole 15, circle two, miss. And that was, and then obviously 16, 17, 18, I ended up not finishing too strong with a five over on the three. But like those holes right there, I mean, that throwing the disc that well, I was putting myself in a position to be able to shoot 12 under, you know, consistently pretty well. Now, I didn't make any of my circle two putts, and I missed a couple of circle one putts, but that's where it's like, right now I feel very confident in my throwing. My forehand feels great, which is awesome, because at Emporia, which I'm playing today, the forehand, if you have it, it opens up so many opportunities for some of these difficult par fours to get you in the right spots without bringing in OB into play. So I feel great throwing the disc. I just got to get the putter hot again.
Yeah. So going into Emporia, have you played both courses this week so far?
So I got in Sunday. I just drove straight in after my round Sunday and was able to kind of just walk around Jones Supreme Sunday. And then yesterday we were going to try to play Emporia Country Club, but the course was actually closed. So, and that's something that we can kind of talk about a little bit, because it caused some issues, I think. But we ended up going to Jones Supreme and got, you know, our practice round in there. They didn't really change too much with it. It does seem like some OB lines have been either tightened or extended. One of the par fours that a lot of people complained about, they moved the basket to where now it was one of those par fours of where it's like if you got a birdie look at it, you were one of the few, where now it's like a must get birdie. So
interesting.
Not too many changes on the course layout. If it's not going to be windy and you're throwing the disc in bounds, you're going to be able to score really well out there. So today we're going to try to go out to Country Club and get around in there. I know they have a couple new holes, they changed up some pins on some, and then they have adjusted some OBs as well. So the courses are going to be playing almost very similar. There's just minor changes on both.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear there's at least changes, because that's what I was about to ask, is like, does it feel weird like you're coming back to DDO in a sense? Like, from a fan's perspective, it's somewhat weird, but I mean, it's also, I don't know, I don't personally like it, but I could see where some people don't really care. But from a player's perspective, is it like monotonous, like, oh, we already played this tournament, we're coming back here, or does it just feel like another week on the road?
Yeah, I mean, I like both these courses. They're fun to play. I would say for like a major, it's in a weird spot though, right? Because obviously the course played so hard for DDO because of just how windy it was.
Yeah.
So it's a weird situation with disc golf, because the wind does affect scores so much more drastically than they do in golf. So you would like to see, you know, let's just pick like what was 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago was Ledgestone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Ledgestone, what'd the winner end up finishing? 30 something?
Somewhere in there. I can pull it up.
Somewhere around there. So I would think, like, for me to like spice it up a little bit, and I think even maybe from a spectator standpoint, you would like to see them do things to make This,
you know, 26.
26. So you, I feel like you would like to see them, you get there and you'd be like, oh, wow, they extended this hole. This hole's a little bit longer now. Or, oh, they tightened the OB here. This hole's a little harder now. Like, to do things like that to make it different in the sense of difficulty, because it is a world championship, it is a major, I think that makes sense. The problem that DDO had, or excuse me, the problem that Worlds has this year is the DDO played so hard. So it's like,
yeah, it can play easier.
So like, what are you going to do? You're going to make, because I think it's, you can look at the weather and be like, okay, we're not supposed to really get wins. And it looks that way. It looks like nothing's going to be over 15 all tournament. There might be some rain coming in,
yeah,
which could be interesting. But like, what are you going to do? You're going to make it even harder, and then all of a sudden, what if wind does?
There is wind coming
now. It's like now the course is almost unplayable. So it is a tricky situation in that regard. But yeah, I would say like you would normally like to see a course play harder for a major, but
yeah, you'd like to see it just get. Like a similar vibe, but just a few strokes harder. I just personally, I think if we're going to a course for Worlds, we shouldn't go to that course for a Pro Tour in the same year. Does that happen in golf? I don't follow golf close enough.
Yeah, it happens. I guess the thing is like the reason why it happens in golf and the reason why it'll probably happen in disc golf as well is I think. You could potentially have a tournament sign for a contract longer than Worlds is decided, right? So, like, yes. Right now, we have no idea where Worlds is going to be in 2027.
We have no idea where it is in 2024.
Okay, perfect. We have no idea where it is in 2024. We have no idea where it is in 2024. So, if TrueBank, which was the title sponsor at Des Moines, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they're like, hey, we really love this. We want to up our contract for 5 years. We want to do this for 5 more years, right? So they do that.
Yeah.
What happens when Worlds gets decided to go to Des Moines in 3 years? And so they're like, oh, well, we're not actually going to have the event this year. That's where I think a lot of it comes down to like the sponsorships at these tournaments. They want to still have those tournaments because
yeah.
They build their marketing and their sponsorships and all that stuff based around them. So that's why I don't see that ever changing of where
that makes sense.
Yeah, of where you're just not gonna have a tournament because
yeah.
Because Worlds is there.
I've always just thought of it from the course perspective. I've never really thought sponsorship wise, but that makes a lot of yep. sense. I still don't love it, but it makes a lot more sense.
And that's why I think it's like you have to kind of beef it up. You have to do something to where it, like you're saying, it doesn't just, because that question of you would never ask that question on the PGA Tour. I've never heard that question before of being like, oh, you guys are coming back to Pebble Beach for the US Open. Like, does it feel like just the same old or what? Like, that would never be a question
yeah.
asked because the difference between the AT&T and a US Open at Pebble Beach is drastic. Like, players know that the greens are going to be running faster, firmer. Players know that the rough is going to be grown out. Players know that they're going to probably have tougher pin locations. They're going to probably move a couple tee boxes back. Like, the course is going to play a lot more difficult. So, that's, I think.
I feel like that's easier to change in golf, though. Because, like, you don't, like, a hole, you could take the same hole and not really change much about the design of the hole. In golf, but like you were saying, make, you know, let the rough grow in a little bit, let the green, you know, I don't know how you let the green harden up, but obviously they can and stuff like that to where it just plays completely different yeah. on the same course. You know what I'm saying? Whereas in disc golf, I mean, you can move the OB in, but we can't really mess with greens. You can put them closer to trees or something, but like, I don't like that. I was going to bring this up. I saw in the debate group, the disc golf debate group, where I believe it was Alex Russell put on his Instagram story.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought this was so. Alex Russell put on his Instagram story and said, are we really going to play a major with branches less than 20 inches from a basket?
I want to hear your and Silas's thoughts on it before I give my take.
I mean,
for those that are listening, we're talking about hole It's like 10 or 11, I want to say, on Jones. And is essentially a basket that sits in between two of those like trees that have like the, they're almost like Christmas trees of where they have like the different rows of branches coming out. And like the bottom branches on this tree, on one of the trees, comes out so far that you can almost, it almost is touching the basket on one side. So that kind of gives you a visual of how guarded the basket is. But yeah, I want to hear what you and Saz think of this.
Well, I'd have to look at the hole as a entirety, but I've played Jones East before.
It's a par four.
So I understand.
It's a par four,
yeah.
And a good drive will leave you probably like 375 to 300. Like people are going to have 375, 300 wide open shot into the green.
And are the trees just on one side of the basket? Or is it like completely circled?
So the tree that is the picture that they're showing, that is on the – so the photo's taken from behind the basket shooting down the fairway. So the tree that he's kind of close to is on the left side of the basket, and then the tree on the other is on the right. So there's nothing in between your shot and the basket, if that makes sense.
But, like, is there, like, a safe area? Like, if you go past, you know you're going to have a putt type thing?
Yes.
Yeah, then I don't mind it. I mean, I can see where, like, 20 inches of the basket, but there's no PGA guideline of, like, it's got to be 2 feet away. And in my opinion, like, that one singular branch looks like it sticks out just far for that tree. So, like, if you trimmed it back a foot, what does it really change about the hole, that branch? I think the question that could be asked is, like, are we playing a major with a tree this close to the basket? But if there's a safe bailout area, I think a tree is a solid defense of a basket. If there is an area where you know if I throw over here, I'm not going to have an obstructed putt because like that's a smart way to protect a green in disc golf. If it's fully surrounded and it's like, no, if I get close to this basket, I'm just in a tree, I hate that. But if it's like just strategically placed trees where it's like, yeah, I just got to get 25 long right and I have a wide open putt, then like I think that's a good thing because then it provides – not OB, but a way to naturally defend the basket without having to get stupid and gimmicky. What about you, Silas?
Yeah. Just to piggyback off of that, I haven't seen the picture, but if it's what I'm picturing, I think, I don't know, it could be a good thing and or a bad thing. And that is because I feel like if you airball a putt and if the tree is that close, it kind of gives you a safeguard. You know what I'm saying? So it kind of just catches that putt. Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't penalize you as much as a wide open kind of green would, but that's just me.
So my take on it is this is one of those where it is rewarding more accurate players. So similar to what you were saying, a lot of times we see a basket and we're just trying to throw it as close to the basket as possible. We're not thinking about, I need to make sure I miss left. I need to make sure I miss right. I need to make sure I'm short. I need to make sure I'm long. We're literally seeing a basket and we're trying to throw it underneath the basket. And if we end up missing any direction, fine, whatever. I'll try and make a 30-foot putt. This is one of those holes where you can't do that. If you miss 15 feet left of this basket, you do not have a putt. So I like it in that sense of where we now went from like having a circle around a basket where anywhere lands in there, we have a putt, we're happy, to where now it's like a small little slice of pie. The slice of pie is short of the basket, like literally directly short of the basket, and like a little bit to the right. I would even say long is the play there, because if you do try to go long, long left is bad and long right isn't great. So like directly long is all right, but like that's why to me it's like the biggest chunk, the biggest sliver is short right. And so I just think it adds a different element. And obviously, it's not something that's super common. Now, obviously, when you get into woods golf, you a lot of times see sometimes trees, like actual trunks of trees close to the basket. And everyone seems to be fine with that. But in this scenario, it is actually a wall of essentially branches and they're not really leaves. It's kind of one of those, it's like one of those ever, it's like I said, it's like a Christmas tree. So it's not, they don't have leaves. They have like those little spiky things.
Like needles.
Yeah, needles. So yeah, if you're left, you just don't have a putt. I'm completely fine with it because we all know it's there. We all know when we're playing that hole that if you do go left, you don't have a putt. So it's one of those situations of where, you know, if you find yourself up over there, you threw a bad shot. So I'm completely fine with it. I think it's definitely something that, like you said, one of the ways that you can protect a basket, because if you do chop all those branches and stuff down, the defense of that hole pretty much goes away.
Yeah, because like that's what I'd be curious is like, if you walked up to that hole and someone like was like, okay, we need a 10-foot perimeter around the basket that's safe or whatever, and then you trim that tree up, you know, 10 feet in, like, and in my head picturing the hole, not seeing it in person, that makes it just a much worse hole. Because like then, like you were saying, approach shots and stuff like that, a lot less thought goes into it. Because then also a tree like that, when you trim it up, you're also removing the defense that the tree provides. So not only is it like a 10-foot circle, but now it's more like you're in the woods and it's just a tree trunk. Because like now if you're under it, you don't have as much of a penalty. Because like, I don't know. I would also be curious, like, if that was OB that close. It's just a wide open field and there's OB. Like next to the basket, just, like that, would people
we
complain?
We just played hole 16 and it was a blind shot. Hole 16 at DMC is a downhill blind shot. OB is 10 feet left and 10 feet behind the basket. So left and long, your OB, and it's a blind shot. I didn't hear any complaints about that.
Yeah. So, that's what's weird. It's weird in disc golf because like I feel like sometimes if it's a water feature, and the basket's right next to it, like, some people might, like, AMs will definitely say, like, well, that's way too close to the water. But most of the time, if the hole's designed right, you aren't going to hear pros be like, oh, my gosh, I have to have a death putt if I go 20
Memorial
feet past.
Hole number one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but then you put certain things in that situation, and, like the, I personally, as a player, I'd rather have the tree there than OB, because if I mess up, I at least have some type of chance to make a putt. Or at least I know I don't have to make a 20-footer for my three. I can just, or for my four, I can just lay up and move on. I would rather have that scenario where the basket's still protected, but it's not protected in a way that's going to like get me a stroke penalty. I just think it's interesting sometimes seeing what people complain about, because I'm like, well, what's the alternative? And also, like, if it was 2 feet or 3 feet, are we complaining? Like, where's the line of like, because he just complained about the branch, not necessarily the tree being there. So it's like, If that branch was 3 feet away, but the rest of the tree is still there, what did it change? Nothing.
So,
at least in my head.
So something that's also interesting, talking about the OBs and stuff, brings up another hole where there is a there's a strip of maybe like 3 or 4 feet of OB. So just think of basically a river, but it's only 3 or 4 feet. And it's like 10 feet short of the FPO basket. Anything short of this, you know, 4 foot gap is safe. And anything long of this 4 foot gap is safe. That's one of those where, like, I don't know if I'm a huge fan of that design, course design. Granted, it's been pretty dry, I guess, up here, so there wasn't any water there. I'm guessing maybe when it rains, there is some water there, so I understand that a little bit. But that course design doesn't necessarily make as much sense to me because
it's a little more random.
I think you're just going to end up having, because it's so thin, it's so close to the basket, you're going to end up having sometimes people, like, miss, like, throw a bad shot and the bad shot gets safe and someone throw like almost a great shot and it gets penalized. Like, to me, why not just make everything short OB?
Yeah.
In that regard, because then because obviously I know what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to basically say, like, if you want a chance at birdie on this hole, you basically have to pure shot
challenge
and get
it
over the basket and then have a challenging putt back. But, like, to me, it's like to take away from the person that threw a perfect shot and maybe the wind just knocks it down a little bit and it hits and it gets, you know, it's 10 feet short, but now it's in this OB versus the person that, like, doesn't even hit the gap and, like, hits a tree and drops down. Like, I don't think those two people should get the same score. So I think that's where it's like, if you could go OB all the way from the tee, now you're setting up to where, like, only good shots are getting rewarded. Everyone knows you need to throw this past the basket.
Well, if that OB, instead of being the entire way back to the tee, if that OB was 20 feet wide, does it change how you feel about it?
I think if you go, the only thing is, though, here's the only thing I don't like about that. If you do, like, 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet wide, what you're going to end up having now is you're going to end up having people not even going for it. And so you end up having, and this, I feel like we've talked about this before, about how in disc golf, if you play safe, it is so much easier sometimes to play safe than it is, obviously, to, like, play. Like, you get more rewarded, I guess, is a better way of saying it sometimes, if you play safe than if you are trying to go for birdies, right? So, like,
yeah, like, the risk-reward doesn't balance itself.
Yeah, like, to me, if you take someone that has a 960, right, like, that's, like, one of the top FPO players. If you take, like, a 960 rated player out to that hole and you had them play it 10 times where they were going for the basket trying to birdie it, and like you said, we make the OB 30 feet, right? You play that hole 10 times trying to go for the basket. Sure, they might get it a couple times, but they're probably going to get a several bogeys as well. So do they end up shooting under for that? Probably. I would say they probably don't. And then you have someone saying, same rating, play it 10 times, but just play for par. You know, they can literally just pitch something off 200 feet, jump putt par every time, like, without fail. So that's where it's like those certain course designs, I think, sometimes will. I feel like they did change. Oh, they did that on, like, hole one. That's a good example. Hole one, you remember the island hole? A lot of people had, like, talks about that. They added another barrier of rocks behind. So now the wall behind the basket is probably, like, almost a foot higher. And then they also have made the drop zone, like, 40 feet instead of, like, 60 or something. So the OB is all the same. So you can still just kind of jump putt off and jump putt on and make your par and move on. But I think they are obviously trying to do things to entice people to go for it versus laying up. So,
yeah.
But those are all very interesting things of, like, how do you make it to where, because that's how you're also going to get a lot of scoring separation, is if you remove the easy par. If you remove the, okay, I'm just going to play this hole for par. I can't birdie this hole. Like, those people that are just like, I can't birdie this hole, so I'm just going to play it for par. If you can somehow remove that of where it's just an easy, easy, easy par, move on. I think you're also going to see some more exciting disc golf, but it's hard. It's hard to do. It's definitely a
fine line. We're going to keep talking about worlds here in a second. Before we get into that, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's podcast. Do you guys happen to know what the fastest growing crime is in America?
Fastest growing identity theft.
You are right.
Wait,
it's identity
really?
Theft, and there's a new victim. Yeah, there's a new victim every 14 seconds. I don't know if you guys ever had,
that's,
you know.
That's terrible.
It's not. Well, you were right. You can cheer for being right, but don't cheer for identity theft. but I've personally had, like, my credit card information stolen before, and you just go on, and it's like that scary moment of, like, hey, Liz, did we actually spend this much at Amazon? And she's like, no. And you're like, okay, thank goodness. But it's obviously a very scary moment.
Isn't it weird, too, that we, like, people talk about this a lot, because when you're in Europe and stuff, they bring, like, the credit card thing to your table, like, when you're at a restaurant. So, like, your credit card never leaves your hand. But, like, here in the States, we just hand someone, some random stranger that we just met, We just hand him our credit card, and we're just like,
that's a good point. And that's kind of what you do with your information a lot of times online, and that's why I'm excited to partner with today's sponsor, Aura. That transition, I mean, I'm pretty proud of that. Aura's identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, VPN, password management, and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. You might have one of these services already, but if you don't have all the tools, it's like locking your front door but leaving the back door wide open. Those who've had their identity stolen are often shocked when it happens. Imagine trying to log into your email account one day only to see the password it's changed hours ago, and then you start getting notifications of activity from your bank, credit cards, crypto accounts, etc. It's a scary and unfortunately a reality for far too many people. Thankfully, Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, passwords, and social security numbers and sends you alerts fast right to your phone and email. Trevor and I actually both have signed up for this. And Trevor, within like 5 or 10 minutes, it found his main password on the dark web like 2 or 3 times. And I fortunately didn't have my password on the dark web, but it found my information, my passwords being sold by like these whatever, whoever scumbags do that, and was able to, you know, help prevent that from happening. So pretty important service here. It also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone was trying to open a loan or credit card in your name, and the VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. So protect your family and yourself from identity theft at aura.com/foundationdiscgolf. It's also linked below in the description. And if you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial with our link so you can see for yourself how many times Aura finds you or your family members' personal info on the dark web. And if you sign up, let me know in the comments down below if your personal information was compromised, because you're not going to regret checking. So huge shout out to Aura for sponsoring today's
identity
podcast.
Identity theft happens a lot too in disc golf. People just taking, you know, they find a disc and it has your name on it, and they're just like, you know what, this is mine now.
That's mine now. Yeah, that's true. Maybe Aura can get into disc golf. I don't know if you can solve that one. We skipped over this at Des Moines. We'll come back to Worlds a little bit. We skipped over
the results a little bit at Des Moines, because obviously with the way that the tournament shaped out, like we had some unfamiliar and some familiar faces at the top of the leaderboard.
Yeah, well, Evan Smith, we got to see at the Battle for Bedford.
That kid's good.
Yeah, well, that's what I said about him and Robert Burridge, is both of them had a complete game. Like watching them play on Sunday, which I think it was a unique situation again because of the storm on Saturday. Evan Smith and Robert Burridge were able to get onto a lead card, stay on the lead card without having to face lead card gallery, camera, pressure until the final day. Neither of them really cracked. Robert Burridge didn't crack at all. Evan Smith, you could say cracked, but he hung around there. It's not like he fell off the face of the earth. So it didn't really affect either of them per se. But I was very impressed with both their games. I think they both have a super bright future ahead of them. And then the playoff that ended up happening was electric. It obviously, I think there was unfortunate stuff on both sides. Simon's unfortunate came via the new Mando rule on hole 12. I don't know if you saw that whole thing.
That was going to happen too. First off, like his first throw, like I was like, did that miss the Mando?
That was the initial
Mando's
question.
So
yeah.
Hard. Like I love Mandos because you have to. Certain holes, like you have, it's an interesting one because not everyone is sold on a Mando, but I think with just how easy it is to manipulate a disc and with how easy it is to break holes, you have to sometimes force players to throw certain shots. You have to, or else the hole, like yes. I think hole 13, I will not be surprised. It was one of the new holes. Would not be surprised if there's a Mando on that hole, because what did I do all 3 rounds? I chucked a spike hyzer up into the trees and just had it plink go down. When you can definitely tell they wanted you to kind of go through that middle gap and then through the tunnel. So I think Mandos definitely are needed. But that being said, sometimes, like this Mando, it is so hard to tell because it's not just like one tree or a flagpole or a telephone pole in the middle of the field, and you're like, yep, you missed the Mando. Like this was like a couple trees all bunched together on the left, and there was just like a Mando sign that said like this way. So like,
yeah,
who knows if he even made the Mando initially. You could not tell in coverage. You kind of lost the disc.
No. And well, Simon even turned around and was like, did I make that? And his car mates immediately were like, yeah.
And most of the time,
you made it. So, like, apparently someone could see he was obviously like, I'm not sure if I made it. And on coverage,
yeah,
I was
hard
clueless.
To tell. And then initially. He got like a ricochet and then another ricochet. And I guess the disc ended up going backwards.
Yeah, it went back. So it went like basically around the right Mando and then back into the restricted space, which the whole restricted space thing, I think this goes back to what we continuously talk about on this show, where the Pro Tour needs separate rules from the rest of the PDGA. Because the whole reason, from my understanding, that the PDGA came up with this restricted space, restricted plane idea is because a lot of times Mandos are used for safety, which my opinion on this has completely changed. If you go back to like early grip locked episodes, I always talked about how I thought Mandos should only be used for safety and they were stupid to have just like in the air. Once I've watched a lot more disc golf and I understand the professional scene a lot more, I flipped. I think Mandos should never be used for safety because like, if you're protecting a playground, you're like with a, you can put a Mando there and yeah, people aren't going to do spike hyzers over it, but someone might still grip lock into that playground, which is not put a hole next to a playground. Also, we're on a Pro Tour. Why are we playing next to a playground? But that was what the PDGA, I'm using the playground because that's what someone from the PDGA used to defend this rule, was like, oh, the restricted space makes sure that even if Simon makes the Mando and then comes backwards, he still isn't throwing through the playground. And it's like, okay, but let's address a bigger issue. Why are we playing next to a playground in that scenario? But a Mando like on the Pro Tour most of the time is used, like you were just saying, to ask you to do this shot. Simon executed that shot. Right? Once he executed that shot, he then got penalized just because he got through the gap and then got kicked backwards.
We got double and got double also, right? Like that's where yeah. I don't like the double penalty there because he would have been penalized enough, I think, because he
get up and down from
the
there.
Mando, so that's fine, but it wasn't a good shot. So it's the same exact thing as someone that makes it through the Mando and has it turn over into the crap over on the left. Like, their penalty now is they're in the crap and they got to try to figure out how to get up and down. Could he have gotten up and down from where he was? I don't know. It's tough to say. They never really gave us a good angle. I mean, I would like to think that there was probably, he probably had a shot, but it was.
He would have had at least a chance to give himself a putt.
So, yeah. I mean, I'm not a fan of that rule. I think that rule.
Well, I don't understand it. I don't get it. I get what they were initially thinking about it, but I think they're thinking in the scope of like local C tiers and B tiers. And then when you take a rule like that and apply it to the Pro Tour, you get something like this, where it's like, this is where it's stupid.
Like,
it doesn't make any sense.
We already have like the luck factor, I guess you want to say, of where on that hole, for example, there's OB right of the basket, right? So you could have a situation where someone throws it through the Mando, clips a tree, goes OB right. Someone else throws it through the Mando, barely misses a tree, and not OB. So you already have like those kind of kicks. I don't think we need to add in like an extra element of something where it's like you make the Mando, but oh, you got a really unfortunate kick, and so now you actually didn't make the Mando. Like, I don't think we need to add in more elements of like flukiness to basically cause issue, would be what I would.
Well, then the other tweet I put out was, if we are doing this, if we are saying restricted space, restricted plane, it's got to be clear. Because like, you had Jeff Spring and the entire card staring at this thing for like 4 minutes on coverage and they couldn't decipher. And I'm like, at that point, like, how are we calling that where he didn't make it?
Because where they are on that right side, because it's based off of the right side Mando, where they are on the right side, the basket is kind of tucked in behind these bushes up by the green, because I'm pretty sure it's perpendicular. It should be perpendicular.
No. The TD can draw at whatever angle they want. So they just had to go off of what arrow, what angle he drew the arrow.
Just off of the arrow?
Just the arrow, what direction that's pointed. That's it. No, the TD can just, like, the PDJ put out a graphic, and the TD can decide what angle that Mando goes. So, like, it could have been pointed back to the T, and then he's completely fine. But, like, it's pointed out, and then it was just an arrow. So then it's like, that's what you heard Evan Smith and them saying, like, which way is the arrow
pointing? For those listening,
pointing?
Too, we're not even talking about, like, there was spray paint on the ground with an arrow saying, continue this line. We're literally talking about an arrow that is like a cardboard or wood arrow that is on a tree. That's like
Oh, was that it? We couldn't tell on coverage. We just heard them talking about the arrow.
I don't remember seeing anything on the ground. I could be wrong.
I didn't know. But regardless, even if it was on the ground, it's just a painted arrow on the ground. In my mind, like, if we're using that, you got to have a string like 30, 40 feet or a line, I mean, or something to where that decision happens immediately.
You kind of have to have a line like really far to the point of where you're like, it's impossible for anyone to go further than this.
Well, that's what someone, when I was this OB rule that a TD taught me is when you're painting OB lines as a TD, go to where you think it's impossible anyone could get here and then paint another 30 feet. And then you should be okay. So I think that applies to this Mando rule, is go where it's like, this is impossible for a disc to get all the way over here, and then add like 20 feet to it. That's and then good, you should be safe.
That's a good way to think about it.
But regardless, let's not add just 1 foot max little arrow and then have the entire card and the literal commissioner of the league staring there and be like, I don't know. Tough call. I have no idea. Because the rule also says it has to clearly cross. So why are we adding ambiguity to the rule by putting the word clearly in there? Because then Simon could be like, hey, guys, we've stared at this 5 minutes. I think it's safe to say I'm not clearly in the restricted
space.
The
one thing I will say about Simon, though, this is playing with him and watching him, is he is one of the guys that you wish you had everyone on tour of, where he knows when there's a rule like that. He could have easily kind of bullied his way or basically was like you were just saying, like, all right, we've been looking at this for way too long. You guys don't – I'm safe. I have to be safe. Like, he could have done that. And there are some people that do that, which make it very awkward. They always – even when they're kind of in the wrong and you kind of know they're in the wrong, they will always try to fight to – he's one of the few guys – I wouldn't say few. That's – didn't mean to say few. There's a lot of people like this. But – he for sure is, and I give a lot of respect to him for that. He's for sure one of the people that is like, all right, I'm OB. Or, all right, I missed the Mando.
Yeah.
And just goes from it.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was able to bounce back pretty quick and then birdie the last like, five holes.
After that hole.
No, I think he parred 13.
Oh, you're right.
And then birdied 14 through 18.
And then birdied the last five. You're right.
Yeah, to get into the playoff. And then, obviously, during the playoff, Robert Burridge, they had – first off, I was very excited it didn't end on three. I was going to be very sad if it ended on three because, like, they both threw a similar shot and one hit a tree and one didn't. Because, obviously, there was just so much talk about hole three's design on the coverage, at least, the whole tournament. So I was very excited on three when Robert hit that, like, 60-footer, whatever he hit, that Simon was able to hit his 40-footer and push it. It was electric for the playoff, but also excited just didn't end on three. And then Robert, obviously, Stumpgate threw an insanely good shot on hole four and just super unlucky break. Just got massive skip off the off a stump, and it didn't even leave him a wide open 40-footer, put him behind a tree where it was a very – actually, I'd be curious your take. What are you running that putt or are you laying that putt up, his putt on hole four?
I would throw a scuba, so it would be like a soft run. It would be a soft run. If you're not comfortable throwing a scuba, then you lay up. You don't, because here's the thing, it's a numbers game. The percentage of you making that putt is drastically smaller than the percentage of Simon missing his putt. Right? So you do the numbers, like you making that putt, 5%, 3%. And if you miss, you're pretty much now is hit. If you miss the putt, if you're trying to make it and you miss the putt, Simon wins. So you're giving Simon at that point a drastically huge advantage versus Simon make. Obviously, he just cashed it in and it was no doubt. But I would still say like there was maybe a 50, 60% chance Simon misses that putt. Right? You gotta take those odds.
Yeah, because I think what people are getting confused with a little bit is like this scenario is a lot different than some of the other scenarios where
look what you did always on hole three. He misses that putt. There's a good chance that goes into the water, OB. But Simon,
but that
Simon
I like that
was
run.
Also in a very Simon was in a much better position on hole three to birdie. He was just outside the circle. So it's like, yeah, in that situation, you've got to think Simon's going to make his putt.
Yeah. Well, I'm all, like, that's what I'm saying. Is like, we've talked about in this podcast and on Grip Locked a lot of, like, when you're in a late game scenario, taking it into your own hands. So it's not like, you don't want to give someone else a chance. Like, if you have a chance to win, you want to take that chance and be aggressive in that scenario. But not always. Because this scenario, in my head, the two options are, if I miss this, I'm handing Simon the win. If I lay up, I'm forcing Simon to take it from me, basically. Because there's also the scenario of, like, I lay up, Simon runs it, clanks off the cage, and it rolls OB. Yeah. I win. Like, that hole, that green's so, you know, finicky that you would hate to...
You know, he just comes out weird.
Yeah. There's a lot of other ways that you still win if you lay up. If you run it, there's only one way you win. And it's if you make it and Simon still misses his. So, like, pretty much either way, you need Simon to miss his putt. I'd rather lay up. But, yeah, I think it was a general consensus he did the right thing. No, yeah, that's what I'm saying. If it was wide open, that I might be having a different conversation. If it was, like, a wide open 40-footer... Yeah, maybe run it because you're feeling great right then. But with that tree,
it was like probably closer to 50.
No, it was like 45. Yeah, because Simon was at about 40 and he was inside.
It was
obviously,
probably close to 50 with a tree. Like, he was gonna have to throw some weird anti putt or some like high hyzer putt from like 50 feet. Like,
yeah,
he did the smart thing there, and you know, it just didn't go in his favor. It didn't work out, and. You know, it's one of those situations, though, as a player, you hope, like, that wasn't your one shot. And after watching him play and seeing, like, you know, all the tools he has, like, it wasn't like he just had a magical run, you know? Like, he showed that he's a player. And I think that's this is so exciting for the Pro Tour, too, now, is, like, because of how disc golf has been in the past, and because of how, like I said, the same people get on feature cards over and over and over again, and you only ever see feature cards, so you never see, you know, you never see the person, you never see Chandler Kramer, who was what, 10 under through 12 or 13 under through 15 or whatever he was. Like, you'll never, it's very hard lot of times to see those people having those crazy rounds. So, like, the name recognition a lot in disc golf is so small, but it's starting to get to the point of where guys are popping off and where you can see these guys jumping up leaderboards and stuff. And I think that just makes it so much more interesting to where, you know, it can come from anywhere. It can really come from anywhere. Someone can have a hot round and all of a sudden, boom, they're up in the competing for the win. So this is, to me, this is what makes, you know, these individual sports so exciting, is when you have a wide variety of people that can pop off at certain tournaments and have a chance to win.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. It did not have any feel like this was the last time we're going to see Robert Burridge or Evan Smith, because their games, there's some players where it's like, oh yeah, this course fits that play style, or yeah, but you can see all these holes in their game and it's just one area is really working. You couldn't really see too many holes in their game, and they also didn't seem to be cracked by the pressure. I think part of it is Robert Burridge especially had such a successful amateur career, winning, I believe, two majors as an am, to where he's been in the hot spotlight, been in that type of pressure. Obviously, it's a different type of pressure, but once you've proven you can win in high-pressure situations, that's a whole different skill that you have to put yourself in high-pressure situations to be able to develop that skill. And to have this type of quality scenario, I guess you could put, this early in your career, highly unlikely that's the last.
It wasn't like he was, you know, it wasn't at like a silver series and he was going toe to toe with another person that's never won before. He was going against, I don't know what your guys' power rankings are, but probably the number one player in the world.
We have him at number two.
Do you have Ricky still one?
We have nobody at number one. We said nobody deserves number one right now. We have Eagle as a ghost number one, and we said, it depending on what he does at Worlds, it's his spot. Okay. He just has to take it. We have a blank number one right now.
I think Simon's the number one player in the world.
Well, that was the next. But the tough part is his last three finishes were like 25th, 23rd, 16th. and then first
sure,
again.
But he's had three wins, and
so is Ricky. And Ricky just won last weekend.
Ricky did win last weekend. But, I mean, your power rankings, you got to go off of, like, you have to, this week, if you're doing power rankings, this week has to count for more than the previous week.
Yeah. What's that? Well, we were looking at going into Worlds 20-something, I think. Or maybe last week might have been 16. It was either 23rd or 16th, somewhere in there. But we were also looking, like, going into Worlds, Eagles coming back for Worlds. Eagle, the only history we have with him is he just showed up and shot incredible at European Open, and if it wasn't for Paul, would have absolutely bullied everyone.
These courses also,
so it's like Eagle's probably the number one player going
like
into it.
Right up Eagle's alley, of course.
That's what I'm saying. Like going into Worlds, I feel comfortable saying Eagle's the number one player in the world going into Worlds. But he also hasn't played, so that's why you put him in that ghost spot where it's like, this is his spot. He just he hasn't taken it yet. Depending on what he does at Worlds, it's his. So that's where we ended at. But I want to bring up one final topic as we wrap up the show. It was also in the Disc Golf Debate group. I thought this was fascinating because of the results. So someone put up a poll and said, what is the most you would pay to play a bad A disc golf course? And then they had $5, $10, $20, $30, $40, $50, $75, $100. And 52% of the people put $20, which is a lot higher than I expected, personally. 24% said $10, 12% said $30. 2% said 5. It did ask the most you'd pay. But I don't know. I just, because when I'm thinking disc golf and thinking pay to play, I think like 10 bucks a round is like the sweet spot in my head. Because you can't have, like we talked about in golf, you have so many amenities that come alongside you paying to play. In disc golf, there's not that many amenities, and the keep up of the course is so much like, cheaper. I don't know. I just thought it was interesting.
I honestly think the greatest thing for golf is carts, right?
Yes.
Like that is the greatest thing in golf is carts. And so like Eagles Crossing is, you know, or even I haven't played Maple Hill yet, but those are like the two kind of pay per play where they have staff out there taking care of the course and all that stuff. Like, does that really do it for me? Probably not. Because how much different, you've played Eagle Crossing. Like, how much different is Eagles Crossing compared to New London as far as, like, in shape?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. It's just the property, I guess, is technically better. But Eagles Crossing, I think, is too expensive, personally.
My point is just, like, when you play New London, do you think, like, oh, man, this course isn't maintained at all? And you play Eagles Crossing.
No.
Because, like, that's the other thing, too, that disc golf or golf has is, like, the greens. If you pay for a cheap greens fee, like somewhere, there's a chance that the greens aren't great. If you're paying like $100 or something to play somewhere, it's pretty much guaranteed that the greens are going to be good. And that matters so much. Mm-hmm. No one likes playing on greens where the ball is bouncing around and all that. Disc golf, we don't really have that. So it's like, and also it's like, does it really care? Do you care if the fairways are like a little, like there's not grass everywhere or, you know, to really for a disc golf course to be maintained, you got to cut the grass. So the grass isn't crazy long. And you just got to have like the tee pads fine. That's it. I can't really think of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the one key, because this will bring us back to Worlds slightly to wrap it all up, is the one thing that's nice about pay-to-play courses is a lot of times it's only disc golf. So that is the property. So you're paying to not have people camping in your fairway or being on another property. Like sometimes the pay-to-play courses right now are on golf courses, and you're like, you're paying, but you don't feel like you belong there to a certain extent. Or like, you know, you were just saying at Emporia Country Club.
We're playing with golfers today.
Yeah, Worlds is there next week. Yeah, Worlds is there next week. You have golfers. Course is closed on Monday. You know, hope the course surely isn't closed next Monday. Which that would be something.
The way that it's set up right now is the PDGA, you have to have the course set up 4 days in advance. So
yes.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday are like the official practice rounds. However, I think Saturday, like, Jones is closed because they're doing the mixed doubles there. Like, the whatever. So,
interesting.
That kind of knocks out one of the practice rounds on Jones. But I guess we can finish the show with just, like, your thoughts on that. If, like, is 4 days enough? Because the thing with disc golf is, like, so many holes are so, like, it's not just, you don't just walk up to a 300-foot shot and go, oh, this, okay, 300-foot shot, this is the disc. And you go to another 300-foot shot, oh, it's the same disc. Like, so many holes are very dependent on not just the wind direction, but also just, like, the shape of the hole. Like, the fact that you can manipulate discs so much, and you might be able to throw backhand, forehand, rollers. Like, I think you do need more time to figure out what you're going to do at holes and more time to practice than you do, like, in a golf situation of where you can play one round of golf. And sure, you might not have all the kind of, all right, I want to miss on this side of the green because this side's, like, that stuff takes a little bit of time to figure out. But for the most part, you can get through a round of golf and kind of have an idea how to play the course. Where disc golf, a lot of times you still have, like, these question marks of, like, okay, I played that hole, but I still don't know if this is for sure the play or this is the play. And now you add the fact that we're doing two courses, so we have to learn 36 holes essentially. Is 4 days enough? That's a good question. Like, is having the course set up 4 days before the World Championship? Also, where we are playing a five-round event. We're not even playing four rounds. We're playing five rounds. Is 4 days enough?
Yeah. Well, I think 4 days is enough to have the course fully set up, meaning, like, 4 days before, you need to have, like, where signs are going to be, OB lines, like, fully painted, all of that. But I would think a week before, you should have, like, the OB flagged. Or, like, at least so the players have an idea when they're playing it. It's not like, for instance, Winthrop Gold. If you show up to Winthrop in the off season and the ropes aren't up, that course is, like, nothing compared to when you show up at USDGC because the OB changes it so much. So, like, if you go out to Emporia and you have a rough idea of what you think the OB is going to be, and then you're like, oh, this shot works perfect. And then you get to there, you play that, you know, today through Thursday, and then you're like, all right, Friday, you show up and you know exactly what the shot is, and it's like, oh, this shot I practiced all week's OB because nothing was flagged, and then on Friday they just paint it. I think that's where, like, I'm okay with the course being fully set up 4 days before, but I do think it should have. Okay, perfect. Because I think to me that's the line of, like, you need to know at least when you're practicing, like, safe, not safe, and then, like, if the banners and, like, the course gets finished, like, polished 4 days before, that's completely fine. Because most of the time, that type of, like, end final touches aren't really changing your play too much. But, yeah, if you showed up in, like, some of these courses, a hole might just look like it's a wide open field, and then you get there, and, like, once they finish the course, you're like, oh, shoot, all this OB's here, and I had no idea or something. That's where I don't think 4 days would be enough. But if the OB's, like, flagged and stuff to where you know, but the PDGA, the four-day limit, does make it where if they wanted to, they could just go out Friday morning and do everything. And to where you could be playing and, like, have no idea what it's going to be like. And then Friday, the entire course changes. And this is
where I think the policy needs to be addressed, because you could say, like, oh, well, the course just needs to be set up. Because, like, you kind of just threw out 7 days or whatever, and you just threw out a day. Like, I think it does need to be addressed of, like, is it 4 days before? Is it 5 days? Is it 6 days? You know, what is it actually? Because you can't necessarily just do, like, after the last event, right? Because if they knew, I'm sure they did, that people were going to leave Des Moines and come straight to Worlds and be here on Monday, you know, they're going to be here Monday, Tuesday, you know, all those days, and the course isn't set up till Friday, like, that might cause some issues, right? But the problem is, like, okay, yeah. Well, what happens next year if the event before Worlds next year is a Silver Series and you have some of the top people being like, well, I don't need points, so I'm just going to go straight to Worlds 2 weeks before. Like, okay, well, now you have a bunch of people there 2 weeks before. Does the course need to be set up now, 2 weeks before? So I do think there needs to be, right now it's 4 days. I do think there needs to be an actual number of days that the course needs to, and like you said, I think that's a good way of saying it, where the course will be like laid out, like as far as playing wise, you can play the course the way it's going to be played X amount of days before the event, and 4 days before the event, the course will be finalized as far as, like you said, banners, bleachers, all that stuff. But I think that's the question of, like, I think that number is probably six. That's kind of what I would like lean towards. And that basically gives you, if you do come in on that day, it gives you 3 days to practice one course, 3 days to practice the other course. And I think that's plenty of time.
Yeah, I think six or seven is, that's just the number in my head where it made the most sense. So, but yeah, I mean, because I don't think Emporia, I don't think there's going to be really issues of like, oh my gosh, like they seem to have everything under control. Like you were saying, that it's already painted, but you could see where it could be an oh my gosh type situation in the wrong scenario.
Last year they painted OBs.
Didn't they change like OBs overnight
like
one time?
Before or something, before the tournament. And like people were throwing shots and being like, this was inbounds yesterday, now it's not. You know, you just want to try to eliminate those as much as possible.
Yeah. Now, what's our plan for the show next week? Are we going to film Monday and still release on Tuesday? Or because you'll have your first round of Worlds a week from today.
Crap, I didn't really think about that. Yeah, how do you want to do about that? We can do. Do we want to do like a little special one and bring in Trevor too for it, since it is the episode before Worlds?
I'm fine with that. Yeah, do it on you and do it on Monday. We'll film on Monday, drop it on Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
it's probably the smartest.
Just come up with if we want to still, because the other thing, I guess we still do grip locked and debate night. So yeah, just come up with maybe a couple things like that we can all discuss leading up to it.
Yeah.
Be good.
Perfect.
Yeah.
We'll do. All right. So that'll be the plan. We'll make a debate night world special. And we'll definitely have you predict what your first round's going to be, because by the time it comes out, your first round will be over. So that'll be interesting. And we can also try to predict what the scores were for that day and just see how stupid we look when it, cause like,
if
when
it's still
out,
tough, you can't,
round one will be over. So I think that'll
be
interesting.
Judge it off of DDL, which is going to be,
It'll be great. It'll be perfect. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Hopefully you enjoyed. Week off this week, technically, for the play, and then World Championship starts next Tuesday. But like we just said, we'll be back here, same time, same place, for you to enjoy. We'll talk to you then.